Hello and welcome to Margin Driving Podcast 141. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing two 21st century movies. The first one is only just a 21st century movie. It's from 2001 and it's Stuart Gordon's Lovecraftian movie, Dagon. Then we move on to 2018, which is in all the papers, for an Australian-filmed, Australian-directed science fiction movie, Upgrade, starring Logan Marshall Green, Betty Gabriel, and Harrison Gilbertson. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we'll start talking about Lovecraftian horrors and computer upgrades that you might not want to get. Martian Drive-In Podcast happens every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, fantasy, and horror appreciation. Sometimes I have guests in, sometimes I'll have a round table. Sometimes it's just random, particularly when there's a Netflix Marvel Cinematic Universe thing coming up. Feedback is the bread and butter of podcasting, so you can put feedback through at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can also email feedback to feedbackpaleo, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can also support the podcast at patreon.com by going to patreon.com/paleocinema for as little as a dollar a week. Just be aware when you're listening to the podcast, there may be some naughty words in it. So if there are kids around, you might want to listen to it later on. You didn't know I could do that, did you? And you didn't know that I knew what a DJ air horn was, but I do. So how's everybody been? We had an interesting week in some ways. It was not a bad interesting week, but a good interesting week. Kind of ad hoc. Sally, myself, and two friends of ours, Sue Ann and Trev, decided we were going to visit a giant lobster, and we did. I'm going to do a YouTube video about it, but I'm going to let you guys know first, so before you get all the visuals. So we decided we're going to visit this giant lobster in a place called Kingston SE, because there are two different Kingstons in the particular state we went to, one up on the Murray River and Kingston SE, which stands for Southeast. So we decided we're going to go there, but the problem is it's 500 kilometres away. So we decided that we were going to stay overnight, and they had to leave fairly early on the day we were coming back, which was Saturday. So I decided that we're going to book a hotel about 100 kilometres east of Kingston SE. So it was easier for them to get home to do what they needed to do the next day. So we booked the hotel, and then on Friday, we drove. Now, we stopped at a few places. There's a town called Ararat, where we stopped and looked at a whole bunch of op shops, which Americans know as thrift stores. Did a bit of thrift store shopping there. We then went to another town on the way called Hamilton. Did more thrift shopping. Got a sandwich for lunch. Looked at a giant concrete bandicoot. I picked up a lot of DVDs and some books that I wanted, which was kind of cool. Got them all for $1 and $2 each, which was even better. And then we suddenly realised that the day was getting on, the shadows were starting to get long, so we had to get to Kingston. So we fanged it across the rest of Victoria, into South Australia, and about 200k into South Australia, until finally we arrived at the lobster. Now, the reason we were going to see the lobster is that Larry the Giant Lobster was going to be sold. When we booked the hotel, when we made plans to go and visit Larry, there was a possibility that somebody in Western Australia was going to buy a 17-metre tall lobster and export it to the other side of the country. So we thought, well, this is a time-sensitive thing. We've really got to go and see him now, because he might not be there next time we kind of get our shit together to go and see him. So we finally, just a day before we were going, suddenly a millionaire farmer, who's a kind of nice guy for a millionaire, who lives in the district around Larry, which is called the Limestone Coast of South Australia, decided he was going to buy it because they were selling for something ridiculous, like, you know, $38,000 with the tourist centre next to it. Which is a ridiculously low price anywhere in Australia. So he decided, yeah, but it's got to stay in the community. Kingston loves the lobster. It's a thing that brings tourists to the town in summertime, and they kind of identify with it in a big way. There are about 1,245 people living in the town. So he decided he was going to buy it. He'd also done a couple of nice other things for the district. He went to the local hospital because of a respiratory ailment about a year and a half ago and found out the roof was leaking. So he had the whole local hospital roof repaired and redone at his own expense because obviously the infrastructure wasn't keeping up. So this guy's kind of on the right side of things for a millionaire farmer. And he bought the lobster. And in fact, when we were there, there was a big sign saying for sale with a big sold sticker over it. So we went there and we had our photos taken with the lobster, which is kind of cool. It's very big and imposing and really close up. It looks like a giant space vagina. And you'll see the pictures when I do the YouTube video. So we went there and then we decided we were going to get some kind of early dinner because the shadows were getting longer and the day was getting on. So we went even further away from our hotel to a town called Robe. I'm going to tell you about the town called Robe because it's my podcast and this is interesting historical shit. 1857, I think it is. That's approximately. There was the great Victorian gold rush. Ballarat and Bendigo were making gold all over the place. The Eureka Stockade, which you will see in the film with Chips Rafferty in it if you're interested, was happening. And everybody in the colony of Victoria was racist as fuck. So the Victorian colonial government, which was working under England at the time, decided that what it was going to do is put a £10 landing fee for anybody who comes from overseas into the colony of Victoria. Now, £10 was a lot of money. It was actually more than the fare to get from England or anywhere else around the place into Victoria. It was a lot of money in those days. And they wanted to keep out the riffraff. Particularly, they wanted to keep out Chinese people. And the Chinese people who were coming from China, obviously, which is a lot closer than England, couldn't get into Victoria because of this egregious and racially motivated fee. So what happened was, the guys who run boats and ships are not stupid. What they did was, they stopped in South Australia at this town called Robe and dumped 36,000 Chinese people in a 12-month period onto the dock at Robe. The Chinese people then walked 400 kilometres to the goldfields across Victoria. So Robe's got this really weird history talking about Australian racism. And there was a stage in 1857 where there were a whole kind of walking wagon trains of Chinese people. And the Chinese people were great when they got there. They opened shops. They were really smart and created market gardens because people needed fruit and vegetables. And the infrastructure just wasn't at the goldfields. So a lot of the Chinese people did market gardens and sold fruit and vegetables and did quite well out of it. A lot of the Chinese workers then went on to basically digging all of the infrastructure for the back roads across northern Victoria, amongst other things, and became a part of the Australian matrix as we have it now. So we went to Robe and had fish and chips. And the sun's setting. Robe's a lovely place. It's got a whole bunch of little lagoons. It's got quite a nice little beach. And so we settled down and had fish and chips, which is very, very good because it's also a port town. Fishing boats come in there, so the fish and chips are really great. So we did that, and then we realised that we had about an hour and a half to travel 110 kilometres on country roads in the rain to get to our hotel before the latest check-in date time, which was about 8 o'clock. So in the dark, in the rain, on a country road, which is very much a B road, at a time where crepuscular grazers turn up. Now, crepuscular, of course, means of the morning and of the evening. And by grazers, I mean kangaroos. So we're kind of aware of the fact that we may hit a kangaroo if we're not careful. We're fanging it at 110 kilometres an hour because that's the country speed limit in South Australia. It's quite a nice speed limit. And we finally got to the hotel. Then we have another problem because I sent the link to Sue Ann and Trev to book into the hotel. And the link that came up was actually for a whole bunch of hotels in the town of Panola. And they booked into a different one than us. But the hotel we went to and the one that we were booked into had spare room. So Trev gets on the phone and had to kind of tell the other hotel, sorry, we got this mixed up. Our friends are staying at this other place. Can we cancel the booking at the last minute? And they were very nice and let them cancel the booking. So we got these two hotel rooms right next to each other. And they were fantastic. They're really big. They're all made out, you know, the wood and brick, enormous vaulted ceilings, really nice amenities, king-size beds, fantastically large rooms. We actually had cups of tea and stuff like that in one of the rooms. You could have got 20 people into each one of the rooms. They were enormous. And so we kind of chilled out, sat around for a while, chatting and having a good time, and then went to bed. Next morning, we said goodbye to them. They nicked off. So Sal and I eventually got up, had a fantastic breakfast in a little cafe in Penola. Apparently, Penola, which is in the wine country of South Australia. In fact, the hotel we're staying at was 8 kilometres out of the town. And I'm info dumping you here, I know. And it's surrounded by Cabernet Sauvignon vineyards for the Coonawarra Estate. And so we get up and there's like ground fog and vineyards around. It's all kind of really nice stuff. Had a fantastic breakfast. And then we decided we're going to visit an extinct volcano in a town called Mount Gambier. So we go to Mount Gambier and visit the Blue Lake, which is an enormous volcanic lake about 1.5 kilometres across. 12,000 years ago, it blew the fuck up and tore the shit out of the whole area around there. But fortunately, in the last 12,000 years, it calmed down a lot. Now, the volcanoes of Mount Gambier are pretty cool. And they are at the end of a range of extinct volcanoes, the other end of which is about 3 kilometres from our place. They stretch all across Western Victoria, all these old volcanic scoria cones, which mark where the volcanoes still to a certain extent are, but they haven't really been doing a lot in the last 12,000 years. So we visit the volcanoes, and then we go down to a nice town on the coast called Nelson, where I heard some fishermen talking about Border Force, which is our border protection thing, which the fascist Tory government has put in. Apparently, on their fishing trawler, they were doing the thing they do, which is fishing, of course. And suddenly they get boarded by Border Force with guns out, high-vis vests and kind of bulletproof vests on, checking the fishing licenses. So they come on full guns, you know, guns out and everything, to check the fishing licenses of fishing trawlers, and acted really kind of, well, fascist. So while we're kind of there and I'm doing a little B-roll for the YouTube video I'm going to do and just kind of chilling on the banks of the Glenelg River, and Glenelg, by the way, is a palindrome, these fishermen are yelling across boats at each other and telling us this story of how Border Force basically came in like Rambo just to check their fishing licenses. They were total bastards about it. So I've got a little kind of anecdotal stuff there about the creeping fascism of Australian society, which was interesting but disturbing at the same time. So we stopped at Nelson and kind of had a toilet break and chilled out and enjoyed the river and the pelicans on the river and the nice fish and the little boats going up and down. It was quite lovely. And then we decided we're going to fang at home. So I put into Google Maps the quickest route to get back to Melbourne, which was about 4.5 hours away. And Google, being the perverse little thing that it is, takes me on all these really kind of back road ways with little one-lane blacktop highways across enormous plains and into little valleys and all sorts of things where I had to kind of dodge around trucks. And so it was a great day. It was a really great couple of days and a totally meaningless and dumb journey to see a giant lobster. So that's what we've been doing this week. And we had a great time with it. The food was good. The company was excellent. Picked up a few things very, very cheaply in the op shops. And we got to see not only a giant lobster, but also a volcanic crater and a fishing boat story about fascism. So it was really a nice couple of days. And just what we needed to kind of clean out the pipes. The cats survived without us. Sally put in about 35 kilos of cat food out for them so they wouldn't go hungry, and a lot of water. And they kind of snubbed us for a day when we got back because we weren't there when we were supposed to be, because we were supposed to be there. But everything's okay now. So that's what I've been doing. Now it's time for...
What has Terry been watching?
Well, only really a couple of things. I've been doing a lot of YouTubing and all those other distraction things rather than the cinema, which is a little bit of a shame, but it happens sometimes. I did watch The Black Scorpion, a 1957 American giant bug movie set in Mexico, starring Richard Denning. It's pretty good. It's got Willis O'Brien stop-motion special effects for the scorpions and for some giant worms and things like that. It's got some nice live volcano footage right at the start to suck you into the film. Maybe Columbia Pictures or one of those smaller studios did it, but it's got some really nice stop motion. There's a scene of giant scorpions derailing a train, which is really great and kind of works within the context of low budget 1950s cinema technology. It was one of the ones that I got, I think, a whole box full of DVDs from Trev. And the Black Scorpion was in it, and I didn't already have it, so I watched it. And it's not a waste of time. It is a lot of fun. It's very much kind of 1950s drive-in cinema kind of stuff. None of the characters is particularly well fleshed out. It's not offensive to Mexican people as far as I could see. It was actually filmed around Mexico City. Obviously, the studio had some bucks to throw around in Mexico and did that, and then got Obi to do the special effects. And, it's better than a lot of the stuff from that time as far as the effects were concerned. So I watched that, and that was kind of cool. I also did something that a lot of people aren't going to do, and I watched Iron Fist Series 2. A lot of people got pissed off with the first one because the titular character was not well written or particularly well acted. But they did some interesting things to remedy that in the second season. First off, they got the fight coordinator from Black Panther to do the fight coordination, and Finn Jones, the guy playing Danny Rand, aka Iron Fist, has done a lot of training. So even though he doesn't come across like a mixed martial arts guy or anything like that, he's plausible as the immortal Iron Fist. And the supporting characters are full of really strong women. We've got Alice Eve playing Typhoid Mary, a character who's got a really interesting and tragic backstory, who's neither a villain nor a hero. We've got a very strong pair of characters that have been in the comics and are really strong in Jessica Henwick's Colleen Wing and Simone Missick as Misty Knight. They are great together and get to beat up some people in common. We've got a very strong wife of one of the Tong leaders in the gang battles that are starting up in Chinatown, played by Christine Toy Johnson, who is really good. Let's see, we've got the Meachums again, Ward Meacham and Joy Meacham, played by Tom Pelfrey and Jessica Stroop, who are involved in there. Sacha Darwin, an English actor playing Davos, the main villain, is kind of cool. He's got a crazy intensity about him, and even though he does have a northern accent, which is kind of interesting, he is playing the opposite of Iron Fist. In fact, becomes the Steel Serpent, a very powerful superhero in his own right. And that really works well. There are some plot twists which are really good in a lot of ways. They're empowering of female characters, which is great. And also, there's a couple of scenes right at the end of the last episode. There's only 10 episodes long, this one, so it's not going to be crazy long for you to binge it, which are very, very cool. They're almost like post-credit sequences, but before the credits. It's kind of redeemed the series. I hope there's a Series 3 because there are so many possibilities in a Series 3 that I want to see happen, particularly Misty and Colleen getting together and forming Nightwing Investigations, as they did in the comics. The action sequences are really great. They use the environment really well. The things that are naturally in a particular environment become part of the battles. And, yeah, it kind of works for me. And all of the flaws in the character of Danny Rand that are in the first season are not brushed over and you know, plastered over, but dealt with face on in the second season. And that's kind of cool. I know there's a lot of money riding on a particular series like this, and of course Marvel's reputation is there as well, but for me, they really did listen and they fixed the things that are wrong. And by having so many strong female characters who are complex and have their own lives apart from the hero, which is very, very important in this kind of stuff. It works really well for me. So I really enjoyed binging that after I got back from the crazy drive to see the Giant Lobster. But there hasn't been too much else that I've been watching. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now. And when I get back, I'm going to talk about the 2001 adaptation of a couple of stories by H.P. Lovecraft by Stuart Gordon, Dagon, which is a kind of hidden gem in horror.
In a boat off the coast of España.
Honey, our staff could be going underwater and we wouldn't even know it.
What are you doing?
I'm just going on vacation.
I'd say we've got a storm coming up.
Brace yourself!
We're gonna have to take the raft into that town for help.
We need help!
What kind of church is this?
What the hell's going on here? I'm supposed to meet someone here. A woman? Senorita? You want to tell me what's wrong with everybody in this town?
I tell you a secret. No one leaves. People come, but no one leaves.
Why are you trying to kill us? What do we do here?
I am here. I've been waiting for you.
Barbara?
Native Dragon.
And the child will be immortal.
If it happens to me, you've got to promise you'll kill me.
Come on, motherfucker.
We are children of Dagon. It is your destiny. Will you forget your world and your friends? There will be no time. No today, no yesterday. Only the forever. And forever. And forever without end.
I don't have a choice, do I?
Okay, Dagon. Well, it's based on two H.P. Lovecraft stories, which, if you know H.P. Lovecraft's oeuvre at all, means that things aren't going to end well for anybody. He wasn't a writer known for his optimistic, sunny outlook on the human race. He was full of elder gods and dark, nameless horrors and all sorts of other things that we now are very familiar with in the era of Trump. Dagon was released in 2001. It's directed by Stuart Gordon, who's had a very interesting, if not entirely successful, movie career. He's done some movies that I like a lot. He did Reanimator, of course, in 1985, From Beyond, Dolls. He did an episode of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Robot Jocks, which is a really weird film, a new version of The Pit and the Pendulum, Castle Freak, Space Truckers, which is kind of cool. And the last thing he did of any real merit was a David Mamet adaptation in 2005 called Edmund, starring William H. Macy and Joe Mantegna and Julia Stiles. Hang on, I was a little bit wrong there. He also, in 2007, he did a movie called Stuck with Stephen Ray and Mina Suvari in it, which is quite memorable as well. So I like Stuart Gordon and I like H.P. Lovecraft stuff. You might be more familiar with the more kind of prosaic Lovecraft stuff like The Dunwich Horror with Dean Stockwell in it and things like that. But Dagon kind of works. It's based on a couple of short stories Lovecraft did, the novella The Shadow Over Innsmouth and an earlier story from 1919 called Dagon. The movie stars nobody that you really know, but I'll go through the credits anyway. Ezra Godden plays Paul Marsh, a computer stock market wizard who's on a holiday on a boat in off the shores of Spain with some friends, his girlfriend Barbara, played by Raquel Moreno, his friend Howard, played by Brendan Price, and Howard's partner Vicky, played by Birgit Bonfarol. They're on this boat travelling around the coast of Spain having a good time when a storm comes up, which is never a good thing on a sailing boat. It blows the boat against some hidden rocks. Vicky gets trapped below deck and Howard stays with her while Paul and Barbara take a lifeboat to a nearby fishing village called Imboca. While Paul and Barbara are away, an unseen sea monster attacks the two people in the boat. Now, that's not where the movie starts. The movie starts with a dream Paul has of scuba diving around under the ocean when he comes upon an enormous opening, kind of well dug into the bottom of the ocean, which has stones and weird carvings on it. And he meets a mermaid, which is kind of foreshadowing for the rest of the movie. But it starts the movie on a very weird kind of place. And you go, where's this movie going? And suddenly he wakes up and he's having a kind of prophetic dream. Paul and Barbara go to this village and it's really weird. The people are strange looking. They've all got kind of clammy grey skin. And some of them seem to have various mutations. And nobody in the village really looks human. It's wet and rainy and windy and dark. And this village of tiny winding streets and old buildings really freaks them out. They get separated after meeting a priest in a church. Now, we followed Paul's journey through the madness that is in Boca. The movie's beautiful. I mean, there are a lot of things I like about this movie. It was made on a large budget, and it's deeply disturbing on a lot of levels. There are some things that happen in this movie which mostly, for the most part, happen off screen, but are really fucking kinky weird. Paul meets an old drunkard who's the last fully human person in the whole village. He's a character called Ezekiel, played by Francisco Rabal. Now, this was Francisco Rabal's last role. But Francisco Rabal was a famous actor in Spain. He'd done any number of quality films as far back as the 1940s. He was in Buñuel's Nazarene and Viridiana and Belle de Jour. He was going to be the villain in The French Connection, but Fernando Rey ended up getting the role, which is a little bit odd. He also worked on William Friedkin's Sorcerer, the remake of Wages of Fear. And just looking through his list of movies, he was not a kind of low-class, unknown actor in Spain. He had been in a lot of good things. Now, Rabal was dying of compensatory dilating emphysema at the time he made this film. And he's not a well man. His face is puffy. He's in his 70s, so obviously he doesn't look young. They give him some really interesting scar tissue in there. And his voice is very croaky, whether that was acting choice or whether that was Rabal's disease, I don't know. But Ezekiel tells Paul the story of how Imboca became the place it was, and how it went from a Christian village of fishermen to a place of half beastly human beings who worship the undersea god Dagon. There's a flashback scene where we see a lot of that kind of stuff, which fleshes out the movie nicely. And we get a real sense of Ezekiel as a survivor. He's kind of disguised himself as an alcoholic so people leave him alone. And even though he's the last human being left in the village, well, fully human being at least, that alcoholism is a disguise and a protective coloration for him. All of this stuff changed when he was a child, and for his whole life, he's been seeing what was happening in the village and knew what was happening in the village and was unable to do anything about it. the characters in the film, he's the one with the interesting backstory, and he's the one that really does pull the narrative together and gives us what we need to know about this fucked up place. All through the movie, it's raining. All through the movie, it takes place at night for the most part. And then something even weirder happens, which is always good when something weird happens. Paul meets a beautiful woman in a bed called Uxia, played by Macarena Gomez. And she's the girl he saw as a mermaid in his dream. And she's beautiful, but kind of bug-eyed and slightly fishy-looking, but Paul finds himself with a real attraction to her. In spite of the fact his girlfriend is missing, in spite of the fact his two friends are missing, he's drawn to Uxia and she's drawn to him as well, which kind of gives us that kind of what-the-fuck feel, what's happening in this movie, which is good. It's actually a positive thing in the film. And Paul finds out that his friend Howard has been skinned because he finds his skin hanging up in a tannery. And one of the ways that the almost fish-like non-human denizens of the village of Imbolka disguise himself is by wearing the tanned hides of people they've killed. This town does not have a good Trip Advisor rating at all. They find Vicky. I'm not going to spoil that part of it because it's an important part of the horror of this film. There's a lot of body horror in this film, plus the psychological stuff. They find Vicky, and he also finds Barbara again. And the movie comes to a very, very strange and memorable climax, which I am not going to spoil. Watch the movie yourself for that part. But as I said in the beginning, this is an H.P. Lovecraft story, and things ain't what they seem in any way at all. And nobody gets out of an H.P. Lovecraft story unaltered, let's say. But it does create a hermetically sealed world for itself, the movie, which I really like. This is a kind of a place and the kind of a story and the kind of a horror that makes a Twilight Zone episode look like a teddy bear's picnic. And the great thing is that a lot of the horrors aren't seen particularly well. The people shambling around the village are seen half-cloaked in rain and wearing big capes and rain gear and masks, of course, from human skin. And we only get to see tiny bits of the disfigurement, the tentacles, the kind of twisted bodies and things like that. They're suggested rather than shown, mostly because of the limitations of the budget, of course, but then Stuart Gordon was known to kind of turn a negative into a positive, as indeed do a lot of budget filmmakers. If you can't show something, use the fact that you can't show something as an added feature. And by keeping it in rain and at night, the horrors of the people of Imbolka really do have a kind of weightiness to them in the narrative, which I kind of like. I like the fact that we don't get characterizations as much as they're more like swarms of creatures coming at this one guy who doesn't speak the language and he's looking for the people he came in with and just doesn't know what's going on until right at the very end of the film. For all the low budget and some kind of ropey dialogue and acting that isn't always the best, this movie has one real virtue to it, and that is that it really does give us a movie that's true to the legacy of H.P. Lovecraft. It's a very Lovecraftian movie, and it works really well. There are some computer effects in the film, but you've got to remember this is 2001. This is fairly low budget, so the computer effects aren't really good. And knowing that they're not good, Stuart Gordon uses them very sparingly. There are a couple of scenes that look outrageously silly, but you can kind of forgive it because it's of its time. We know that it was limited budgets. We know he was trying to show us something that couldn't be shown any way but using computer effects. And so if you're in a generous mood when you're watching this film, and I think you should be, you really need to kind of go, okay, I understand that. I understand why it's like that. I understand why the special effects on the CG part of it are if seen in the right light, a little bit laughable, but in the context of the movie, they kind of work. The movie is actually written by Dennis Paoli, who'd done a number of other things. He was the screenwriter for Reanimated from Beyond, Ghoulies 2, not Ghoulies 1, but Ghoulies 2, Spellcaster, The Pit and the Pendulum, Castle Freak, and Dagon. He hadn't done a lot since then. He did write a couple of episodes of the Masters of Horror TV series about 11 years ago, which is kind of an interesting choice. He co-wrote them, and with Stuart Gordon, who directed them for the TV series. I'm really going to have to revisit Masters of Horror, the TV series. There was an H.P. Lovecraft's Dream of in the Witch House and an episode called The Black Cat. So these guys were deeply, deeply into Lovecraft. And Edgar Allan Poe, of course, because The Black Cat's an adaptation of an Edgar Allan Poe story. So Stuart Gordon and Dennis Paoli were real Lovecraft freaks, and probably still are too. They've both got a pulse and they're still around about. Stuart Gordon doesn't have any credits past about 10 years ago. He did an episode of a TV series called Fear Itself, which is a Canadian anthology series, in 2008. But I kind of like his work. I think it's, for the most part, with the two exceptions at the end of his career, very kind of VHS-era horror stuff, fairly low budget. But anybody who lived through that era, going down to the video store, renting VHS tapes, I mean, I came back with arms full of them. They usually had the weekly ones, like you get 7 for $10 or something like that. So I'd go down and devour the things and ruin the heads on my VHS players doing so. So they're very much of that time, and kind of if you live through that time, you've got an instinctive fondness for this kind of a film. If you're from a later generation or the you didn't do the VHS renting lots of stuff kind of thing in the 80s and 90s, then you might not quite understand. But for me and for a lot of people I know like me, you get a nostalgic fondness for this kind of a film. And I think it's an honest adaptation of the original works. I think that they went with the horror without being at all gratuitous. There is some nudity in it, but you've got to expect that. And the nudity isn't particularly titillating because of the context. I think that the stuff that came after Stuart Gordon's oeuvre, the torture porn kind of stuff, really, it had its day about 8 or 9 years ago. But I think that people like Eli Roth and those guys, one of the things they forget is that what the whole idea of a horror movie, apart from scaring people, which is perfectly valid and perfectly okay to do, you also got to be entertaining and alienating an audience and showing an audience things that really are going to piss them off more than entertain them. Doesn't work, but I think a movie like Dagon does provide that entertainment. It builds a world beautifully, and I think that that's a difficult thing to do at the best of times, but I think that in the limitations that Stuart Gordon had in this one, he did it very, very well. So there's not much else to say about Dagon, except I enjoyed revisiting it, and I've forgotten details, as you do when you watch a whole bunch of movies. They tend to kind of override each other in your mind to a certain extent, particularly when you watch a lot of horror movies and a lot of schlocky things like I do. But I remembered that I liked it when I first saw it, and revisiting it, I understood again why I liked it. So anyway, I'm going to take another break, and when I get back, we're going to 2018, that weird and wacky year full of fake news and deep state and all those other kind of weird things. The Me Too movement. Remember all of that stuff that happened in 2018? Well, we're going to do a movie from that year, and that movie is Upgrade, an Australian-American co-production directed and written by Lee Whannell, who 10 years ago wrote the first Saw movie with James Wan. And it's a cyberpunk thriller with some body horror chucked in, which I kind of like.
As a quadriplegic, must be frustrating for you, someone who likes to get things done with their hands.
Here's the thing. 4 guys murdered my wife. Don't you touch him! If I could find these men, I'd do it.
What if I told you I could offer you something that would enable you to walk again? I call it STEM, a computer chip that has the potential to change everything. It's a new, better brain.
I am STEM, the system operating your body for you.
Can anybody else hear you?
No, only you. May I point something out? In the drone surveillance footage.
Sir Brantner, Marine Corps, address 414 Citrus, New Ground.
We'll need a plan.
I got this.
This doesn't seem like a well thought out plan.
I need your permission to operate independently.
Permission granted!
Thank you.
Stay down, man.
Sam, he's got a knife!
I see that. We have a knife, too. You now have full control again, Gray.
If you are involved in this somehow, then you need to let me know.
Well, I was in the area, Detective.
There was a gun implanted inside his hand.
Then what do you think I should do?
Move, Gray.
Man, you are persistent.
I cannot allow us to be killed. We are going to finish the job we started.
You didn't know that I'm a ninja.
While I am state-of-the-art, I am not a ninja.
I actually heard good things about this movie before I saw it, which is one of those things that usually I should listen to a lot better than I do and see things a lot sooner. It was filmed in Melbourne, this one, which is kind of cool because that's where I live. And a lot of it was filmed around Docklands and Docklands Studios, which weren't too far away from where I used to work when I was a member of the workforce. The big highway car chase is on the Hume Highway up near Craigieburn, which is the road I go to when I drive to Sydney to visit family. I go along the same road where the car chase to upgrade takes place. And I'm going to kind of try to remember that next time around and be aware of the possibility of self-driving cars pranging into me unexpectedly because they've been taken over by rogue AI. The story starts out fairly simple, and the movie, to some people, has been called one part $6 Million Man, one part Death Wish Revenge Fantasy. But that's only half the story, really. The setup's pretty simple. A guy called Gray Trace, which is one of those names you only ever get in cyberpunk movies, played by Logan Marshall Green, is a stay-at-home mechanic. His wife works for a big corporation called Cobalt, which is one of the companies contributing to an increasing computer-human augmentation in the near future. He gets his wife to come along with him where he's returning a refurbished car to a client called Erin Keane, played by Harrison Gilbertson, an Australian actor who does a really nice job of playing kind of a creepy, somewhat on the spectrum, genius Elon Musk kind of character. Erin, for reasons of his own, shows them his latest innovation, which is STEM, an AI chip that can serve as an auxiliary brain to a human being. This is a future where almost everybody has some kind of cybernetic augmentation. Gray is one of the exceptions. He works on old cars. He's a kind of old-fashioned guy in a lot of ways and didn't go in for any kind of augmentation at all, and likes working on mechanical stuff rather than computery stuff. And that's who he is, and of course that's important later on in the plot that he is like that. Now, on the way home, Gray and his wife Ash's self-driving car malfunctions, and it crashes into a homeless camp down in Docklands. I know where it is because I know the Balti Bridge that it happens near. They set up a kind of nice little textured world for this movie. Four men arrive. They shoot his wife in the stomach and kill her. And they shoot him in the neck, severing his spinal cord. He watches his wife bleed to death next to him. I'm kind of paraphrasing from Wikipedia here. He's a wheelchair-bound quadriplegic. He goes home. He's under the care of his mother, Pamela, played by an Australian actor who's done a lot of good work on television, Linda Cropper. Never got the breaks she deserved, but she's really good in this one, in a fairly small role. And she has the ability to kind of make it feel lived in, even though it's underwritten and it's very much a supporting role. She does a lot with it, which I kind of like. I like actors who give more than they're given by the script and do well with it. As you might understand, Gray, being a kind of physical hands-on guy, gets depressed by the fact that he's a quadriplegic. He does have robot arms that can feed him and look after him in various ways and give him the medication that he needs. And at one stage, he does attempt suicide by trying to con these robotic arms into overdosing him on the medication he needs to take each night to stay alive. That doesn't quite work. So Gray is contacted by Erin again, who tells him that if he inserts the stem chip to breach the gap in his spine where his the body and his brain don't link up on the spinal cord, then he will be able to walk and talk and, well, he can still talk, but walk and move around and do everything physically he could do before. Gray jumps at the opportunity, of course, because why the hell wouldn't you? So in Erin's kind of underground home, which is kind of cool, the stem chip is implanted. I'm having trouble with words tonight, I'm sorry. And almost immediately, Gray can get up and walk around. What he doesn't know at first is that Stem has a voice, played by a guy called Simon Madden, who's actually Australian, even though the character voice does have an American accent. Simon Madden, born up the road in Ballarat, not far away from here, an Australian actor. He was in a bunch of films that I like The Dressmaker and, let's see what else, Jack Irish. He did the Jack Irish TV show. So he's kind of a decent character actor himself. Romulus, My Son, which is a movie Eric Banner did here in Australia. So there's a lot of talent working on this film, local talent, which obviously isn't too expensive, but really does lift the movie above what it should be. It gets a 7.6 on IMDb, which is not too bad for this kind of a film. So some people attack Gray for reasons he doesn't understand at the time. And what they are ex-servicemen who are cybernetically augmented. They've got guns in the palms of their hands and they load the bullets in through slots in their biceps, which is kind of part of the body horror. This movie is the really kind of cool cybernetic enhancements that certain people have. The main guy he's going up against is a guy called Fisk, played by an Australian actor again, called Benedict Hardy, who's got a kind of lean, hungry look. He'd make a great Iago in Othello. And he's one of the cybernetically enhanced soldiers. There's a bar scene where they go into a kind of cyberpunky bar, and Gray goes there to get information about the people who killed his wife. The bar's being run by a guy called Clayton Jacobson, who's a movie director himself, and he's the brother of Shane Jacobson, who did the Australian movie Kenny. In fact, Clayton worked with him on it back about 15 years ago. And there's a beautiful death scene for Clayton Jacobson in this one, because some of the weapons that these cybernetically enhanced ex-service people have aren't immediately obvious. They can kill you with a sneeze. And we actually see Clayton Jacobson's character get killed by Fisk sneezing. What everybody doesn't know, and that we see very nicely in the film, and which is a nice little extra touch, is that there are a whole bunch of nanobots in the sneeze, and they kind of fly towards a target, dragging, unfolding hooks behind them. So you breathe in the nanobots from the air that the person sneezed out, and they go in and tear your brain apart from the inside. Now, that's a nice little bit of work there. It's not entirely unknown to people who are familiar with cyberpunk as a literary genre. A lot of that kind of stuff comes from there. But it's nice to see it on screen, and it's nice to see it kind of applied unexpectedly, because we didn't know exactly why this guy sneezed suddenly. But the very concept of somebody who can kill you with a sneeze is very, very cool. So with the assistance of STEM, first thing that Gray's got to do is get STEM hacked, because Erin's trying to disconnect STEM and close STEM down with a remote signal. And Gray needs to get a hacker to basically rootkit the chip, in a sense. And he writes down all the rootkit instructions on his arm with a texter. And they go and find a gender-inspecific hacker in a little kind of sleazy, warehousey kind of place. And that's a nice scene too. We find out one of the interesting things that I found out, based on what Gray writes on his arm as the rootkit instructions to stop STEM from closing down and him becoming a quadriplegic again, is that STEM's basically running Linux, because there's, you know, a sudo apt-get kind of instruction set on the rootkit, which is kind of cool and interesting. And I kind of like the fact that they at least went that far when they were planning it in the script. So that's kind of fun. But things ain't what they seem. Let's just put it that way. Now, this movie has a lot of cool things going for it. The action sequences are very, very adept. They're well done. One of the kind of ways that they demonstrate that Gray's not in charge of his body when STEM goes totally Rambo on everybody is the camera follows Gray really closely when his body contorts around. And the way they did that was getting Bluetooth-enabled cameras and having a Bluetooth-enabled phone on the body of Logan Marshall Green, so that the cameras could focus on that Bluetooth signal and follow the Bluetooth signal on the phone that he had strapped to his body. So as his body jerks around, the camera follows that exactly. And it gives us a very kind of strange camera feel, which works well for the movie. The budget on this one was $3 to $5 million, which even here in Australia isn't a large budget. But it's all up there on the screen. It really does give us, first off, it gives us an interesting and not implausible future. We've got driverless cars with screens instead of windshields. So if you want to, you don't have to see the road ahead of you. But if you want to, the screens basically show you the road ahead of you. We've got tiny, tiny phones, which are basically only earbuds and that work on voice commands. We've got all sorts of technologies, which including smart tables and smart coffee tables. Even a poor person can afford a smart coffee table where their voicemails are and things like that. So it's a really textured and lived-in world that works well, and works well because of what we can do now, of course, with computer graphics. And one of those things I hate in movies, and they did this more in the 80s and 90s than they do now, is there'd be some kind of whiz-bang technology used in a science fiction film of a certain age. And anybody who's kind of up on it and read Wired magazine and an occasional New Scientist knew that the real state-of-the-art in the real world had superseded whatever the future is there. But this movie doesn't have that. What it does is it extrapolates on what is being planned now and integrates it into the world nicely. It's a very much a world of the privileged and the 90%, 99% living pretty bad, which is very much an extrapolation on socioeconomic factors that are now at play in our society. And one of the things I'm going to find that really interesting in the next 15 or 20 years is looking back on the futures that are generated in the age of Trump. Because I think that there's a pessimism about the 1%, and there's a increasing knowledge of inequality and prejudice and the ways in which moneyed power manipulates a lot of different things that really is going to inform and define our current era in the future of film history. But as I said, the movie does have that beautifully textured future. It also has a villain that we don't know is the villain, which is kind of cool. the reasons why things are being done and who is asking for things to be done, who is working on doing them, their motivations aren't clear until towards the end of the film. And it's a nicely tailored little script because of that. We've got another character in there who comes up, Betty Gabriel, another American actress, an actor of color, who plays a cop investigating all the crimes. And she's kind of good. She's running solo on this, and of course the budget didn't allow her to have a sidekick or anything like that. But she does good with not much in this one. She's a plausible character as a police investigator. She's smart. She doesn't have all the information, but she's willing to follow the leads and get the information. And her character is, in some ways, the most likable in the movie because we understand her motives. We understand that she's a good person and she's focused on the rule of law. And she does a really nice job of it. There's some action sequences she does really well in. And in some ways, she kind of reminded me of Simone Missick's Misty Knight, but without the cybernetic arm. She's got that, you know, tough woman of color, I don't take shit from anybody attitude, which I kind of like. I'll be honest with you, I didn't see the end of the film coming. Maybe I wasn't paying attention to that. And I was paying attention to the layering and the texturing of the technologies and the world creation. But for some reason, I didn't see it coming, which is kind of nice. I like it when a movie surprises me. I hate it when I'm two steps ahead of the screenwriters and know exactly where a movie's going. This one doesn't do that. But what it does logically, and it does make a lot of sense when it happens. Now, sorry if I'm being kind of obscure and oblique in doing that, but this is a movie I don't want to do spoilers for this time around because I think it's cool. I want to see more Australian cyberpunk movies. I want to see more Australian science fiction movies in general because over the last 10 years, there have been a bunch of them that are really punching above their weight in the world scene. There are movies like These Final Hours I like a lot. Some movies I've talked about on this podcast in the past, and you can go back and listen to the episodes. I really want to see more genre films from my home country because apart from the fact that there are some actors out there who are really, really good at what they do and I like seeing them do it, I think there are some writers and the technical people are fantastic here and they have a passion and a hunger to tell stories from our viewpoints. And even though this movie is technically set in America, the locations and the actors, for the most part, are Australian, though I would have liked to have seen it set in Australia because I think that would have kind of worked. Maybe, I mean, people like Lee Whannell and James Wan know more about the American market, whether they're going to accept an Australian set movie with this kind of thing for American audiences. I don't know. The movie was actually produced by Jason Blum from Blumhouse. Now, Blumhouse is the film production company which is doing really interesting work at the moment. They started out, when were they started out? Probably with Insidious and Paranormal Activity about 11 years ago. But I'm just looking through the list of Blumhouse movies and it's really impressive. Lords of Salem, all of the Purge movies, all of the Insidious movies. Let's have a look here. Ouija, Jezebel, The Town of the Dreaded Sundown remake. Let's see what we've got there. Split is a Blumhouse movie. Creep 2, Happy Death Day, which I kind of enjoyed. Let's see what's upcoming. Black Klansman is a Blumhouse movie, for instance, the Spike Lee joint. And the sequel to Happy Death Day to You, in 2019 is one of theirs, as well as Glass, the sequel to Split. So Blumhouse is doing some interesting stuff. Oculus is one of theirs as well. So every time I see a Blumhouse logo, I know it's either going to be a movie that's so darkly, horribly, torture-porny and horrible that I'm not going to want to watch it, or it's going to be a really interesting movie that's kind of at a slightly different level to something, say, Eli Roth would have done with The Green Inferno. But just to wrap it up with Upgrade, see it. It's a good action film. It's a good science fiction film. Even though the characters aren't fantastic and the acting is no more than it needs to be in some cases, I think that the story and the concepts will carry you through it, as well as all of the action sequences. You know, knives through hands, people getting smashed in the head, people getting their heads blown off, but it doesn't linger on that kind of stuff. It really does work, and it's a movie that I'd recommend. It really is at that level of science fiction action body. Let's see, my mouth again. Science fiction action body horror film, it says here on Wikipedia. And if you don't like any of those things, you're not going to like this. But if you do, definitely go for it. I want to see more Australian films. I think Blumhouse should be ponying up and letting us tell our stories our way with characters who have our accents. So that's just a word if Jason Blum for some reason listens to this, which is incredibly unlikely. But anyway, that's about it this time around. I'm going to redo the credits because Steve Sullivan, his credit's been going wrong for a while. I'm getting Steve Sullivan onto the podcast soon. We're going to talk about Mothra and some other kaiju kind of films. But rather than getting everything redone right now because it's getting late at night, Steve is and will always be the director of Monster Effects for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Drive-In Podcast. I'm really sorry about that, Steve. Just looking through what we've got here, looks like we're going to be doing Mothra and Mothra versus Godzilla, aka Mothra versus the Thing. So that's going to be kind of cool. We can really rock with that. I'm going to liaise with Steve, who's an interesting guy. He's an author as well as a monster movie fan, and we're going to talk on Skype and really kind of just get our kaiju on, because I'm going to be doing some more Japanese kind of stuff for future podcasts rolling into next April when Sal and I head for the Land of the Rising Sun. So anyway, I'm going to put the credits through just as they are at the moment, and one of my jobs for next week is to get them fixed. But again, Steve, I apologize. And hopefully I'll talk to you soon and we'll have a great time talking about monster movies. So anyway, here are the credits. In the meantime, look after yourselves. Take care. Things will get better. If you're going through a rough patch, things will definitely get better. Watch some good movies. Watch some bad movies. Keep watching the skies. I'll be back next week with Paleo Cinema Podcast, in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In Podcast. So, of course, here are the credits in the style of movie credits to honour the people like Steve who support the podcast with pocket change every month via patreon.com/paleocinema. So take care of yourselves. I'll be back very soon. I may throw a bit of music at the end of the podcast. You just don't know. So here are the credits. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Drive-In Podcast, done in the style of film credits. I'd like to thank Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, our musical director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, the casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, the second unit director, Paul, the special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, our script doctor, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Eric, the set security lead, Richard H., the set photographer, Mark D., the extra, David L., the extra, and Richard C., our transport co-captain, plus Andrew, our necessary film critic. We have Kerry H., our accountant, and Kerry L., our other spiritual advisor. Thank you so much to all the patrons for dipping into their pockets and helping out with the podcast. This has been a Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In production. The end.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me. Don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around. When it seems your friends desert you, there's somebody thinking of you. I'm the one who'll never hurt you. Maybe that's because I love you. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around. Now don't forget me, 'cause if you let me, I will always stay by you. You gotta trust me, that's how it must be. There's so much that I can do. If you go, I'll be right with you. You and I should be together. Love I long to give you, I'll be at your side forever. Call me, please call me. Call me, tell me and I'll be around. Don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around.